Hello and welcome to the Let's Talk Bipolar podcast, hosted by Emma Bell and brought to you by Bipolar UK. You can find all of our resources at www.bipolaruk.org. Welcome to this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, the podcast. And in this episode, I have got Dr. Claire Dahlman with me, and she lives with bipolar, and she also has a significant role in working with Bipolar UK in a professional capacity. She juggles a couple of hats, which she's going to tell you all about in a minute. So welcome, Claire. How are you today?
Hi, Emma. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you very much. You can see I've got a lovely, lovely background.
So. I want to be there.
Yeah, exactly. Keeps me happy.
So Claire, tell us about you. I'd love you to introduce yourself to our audience in your own words. There's so much to you and what you do, and we'd love to get to know you.
Okay, fine. I was diagnosed with bipolar 1 when I was 23, and I realised in retrospect that I probably had about 7 or 8 years of mood swings that were, you know, gradually getting worse. And I had had a severe mania the previous summer. My episodes were very related to the seasons, and I sort of up in the summer and down in the winter. And I'd had that severe mania, but, you know, nobody recognised sort of what it was or whatever. And then I'd had a severe depression. And then the second severe mania, along with sort of accompanied by various car crashes and, you know, things like that, and things going wrong and chucking jobs in and all sorts and dropping out of university and lots of things. So eventually I got dragged off to hospital and... got the diagnosis, and I was quite shocked. When we're talking a long time ago, because I'm quite old, and so it's like nearly 40 years ago. And the worst thing that happened to me, apart from me thinking, you know, God, my life is over now, kind of thing, because I had been quite successful at school and things like that, you know, and thought, and you know, had a socially was everything was great and whatnot, and thought I had a good life ahead of me. And so to be in psychiatric hospital, and also to be told, I was told by a psychiatrist there, not the one, my regular one, but another one, said to me, do you realize that you know, your life will completely change now? And he said, you won't be able to have children. And I was, and this happened a lot in those days, and I've still had this from other people have told me this since, but in those days it happened a lot. And I was just completely knocked sideways by that. And luckily, when my regular psychiatrist came back from wherever he was a few days later, I told him this, and I said, you know, is this true? I just can't believe it. And he said, you know, I wouldn't say that. He said, you know, he said, we'll see how you get on. So I was kind of, you know, that made me think this is much more serious than I thought it was. And anyway, so, you know, because of the stigma as well, I mean, thankfully things are, you know, are quite a lot better now, but, you know, we're not all the way there. No. But because of the stigma, I just sort of kept very quiet about it. But I was very, very lucky because I was put on lithium. And I'm a fantastic responder to lithium. You know, 30% of people are very good responders to lithium, and it like works a treat for you. So it's like having insulin if you're a diabetic, you know, it almost just levels you out, you're absolutely fine. And the only sort of side effect that I had, I didn't have any physical side effects at all, was a slight sort of dulling, you know, so I did feel intellectually slightly not as sharp as I had been. But you know, I'm not quite sure whether that was the lithium or just, you know, having had 2 or 3 bad episodes, really, because I think the research shows that that can affect your brain. But, you know, I managed to go and train as a journalist and work on the newspaper and things. And, you know, but I never thought, whereas before I would have thought, I'm going to be a Fleet Street, you know, editor or something like that. Now I just thought, I'll just keep my head down and just try and do, you know, a basically good job, because I feel that's what all I can do, you know. Mm-hmm. And I didn't tell people around me, apart from a couple of close friends, about my diagnosis. But anyway, so I got married and decided we wanted to have children, and I had a regular NHS psychiatrist at the time, and she said I should stop my lithium, you know, gradually. Mm-hmm. And I did that, and luckily I was fine in pregnancy, but as soon as I had the baby, then within a few days I started to get ill. And so it's that experience really which has shaped a lot of my work later in life. Mm-hmm. Because I got better from it. I spent 5 weeks in hospital. I had a postpartum psychosis, but it wasn't from all the women I've interviewed about their postpartum, it wasn't a particularly terrible one. But my husband and I, you know, knew what was happening, and, you know, I couldn't sleep and et cetera, et cetera. And was becoming a bit paranoid and stuff. And I went into hospital for 5 weeks. And subsequently, I wanted to have another child. And I sort of researched it and decided what I had to do, and that mm-hmm. There was no way I was going to breastfeed this time, because there's no, you know, I had to go straight back on my lithium.
Okay.
And I had to make sure I got my sleep and things. So, and it was at that time I was fine. I didn't have any postnatal problem at all. So years later, just to fast forward, because I'm probably going on too much.
No, not at all.
I decided when my kids were in their teens that I really wanted to investigate psychology more and go back to uni. And plus, I kind of, you know, like a lot of us with bipolar, you sort of lose your confidence. Mm-hmm. And so I'd never gone back. I'd sort of traveled around a lot with my husband's job, and I'd never gone back to work on a paper or anything, you know, apart from doing a bit of freelance. So I didn't feel comfortable going back into that world. And so I decided to go back to uni and do psychology in English. And amazingly, it was so fantastic for me. I mean, I was in my 40s. It was so fantastic for me, because it completely gave me back some of my confidence anyway, mm-hmm. because I did very well. I came top and this and the other, you know. And I really loved doing it. I absolutely loved doing it. And I had, you know, a paper published and this, that and the other, and got a prize and stuff. And so it really did help my self-confidence. And also a really fantastic bit about it was I decided to do my final papers on bipolar, and so I got involved because of that with the charity, and I went to a national conference, and I was just blown away by, you know, being there with all those people who had the same thing as me, and also they were so great. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was so much enthusiasm in the room, and there was a lot of positivity. And although there were some, you know, horrendous stories of the stigma that people had suffered and things like that, and the poor services that they got, there was also a huge amount of positivity. And so I just thought it was great, and I went and offered my services because they used to have a magazine. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I can write a few articles and stuff if you want. And so the first article that I wrote was, if you have bipolar and you're thinking about having children, mm-hmm. you know, then you should think about, you know, I'll do this article about this. So I did quite a long article about both my experience, how to avoid getting ill, hopefully, mm-hmm. you know, practical tips and things, and also you know, some actual sort of research information. And I interviewed Professor Ian Jones, who yes. is already a great friend of the charity then. And so, and meeting him, talking to him, you know, I was going to start, they'd asked me if I wanted to do a PhD at my uni, and I was going to do one about comedians and bipolar. And I started all the work for it. But and talking to Ian and stuff, and he sort of got me very involved in thinking about, he said, you know, what happened with your pregnancies? Were you well? You know, were you well afterwards? Because that's his real area.
Yes.
And I told him what had happened because I just thought of it as a bipolar episode. I'd never even heard postpartum psychosis. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just thought, oh, it was my bipolar playing up kind of thing. And he told me, you know, he said, no, that was a postpartum psychosis, you know, and I'm doing this research and everything. Will you be involved in it? So I got involved in that research. And then from then on, I thought, I don't think I want to do this thing about comedians because this is so important.
Yeah.
So many women have, you know, so many women don't know anything about doing, about having children. There's no information for them because Ian asked me to do workshops with him because he'd started doing them when the first program came out of Stephen Fry.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lady on that who was a trustee on the charity's board, and she did the program with him. She was interviewed by him about having her child, and she started doing workshops with him, and she committed suicide, unfortunately. Aww. when the little boy was quite young. And Ian said, you know, it's terrible and everything. He was terribly upset about that, but he said, you know, it's really important to do these workshops. Will you do it with me?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that we had the professional view and the service user point of view.
Yeah.
And so we started doing those workshops, and my God, you know, so many women, they had had the most horrendous experiences, and they'd sort of been told to give up their medication immediately, and then they'd got incredibly ill.
Mm-hmm.
Or they particularly, I remember one of them, because I was trying to be upbeat about it and say, you know, this could happen, but if you know, if you're armed with the information, you've mm-hmm. got the best chance of, you know, avoiding it happening and yeah. dealing with it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I said, you know, I came off my lithium and then, you know, this happened and this happened and the other, and it all turned out great in the end, you know. Mm. I've got two lovely children and blah blah blah. And a woman in the front row said, I was exactly the same. I came off my lithium, and then in my pregnancy, I was so ill that I had to have an abortion, and then I had to be in hospital for 7 months.
Oh.
And then the woman next to her said almost the same thing happened to me. And I was just like, oh my God, you know.
Yeah, so these poor women ended up having termination for maternal mental health reasons.
Exactly, exactly. And so it was so shocking to me, and so many stories of women who couldn't get information about what they were supposed to do. You know, they had the best intentions, and they were being really responsible, trying to find out
mm-hmm.
how they could help themselves and avoid getting ill. And yet nobody was helping them because, you know, if they went to the GP, they didn't know anything about it.
No.
They went to their general psychiatrist, most general psychiatrists. I mean, now, you know, we've done all this campaigning and it's a lot better. But then general psychiatrists knew nothing about it either, because it is mm-hmm. a specialism, perinatal. And they most of them were very, very ignorant about it. So I, you know, was very shocked about it. And I thought, well, this is much more important to do a PhD about than comedians, yeah. I'm afraid.
And it is really important. You know, I get so many messages from people saying, what do we do if we get pregnant? I want to have children. I'm scared to have children.
Yeah.
I've had similar thoughts. You know, I've had thoughts myself. You know, I've not been scared of having children. I'm struggling to have children, as you know. But I've not been scared to have children. But it's always in my mind, how am I going to keep well? How am I going to avoid being very unwell? What do I need to put in place? What do I need to delegate? What do I need to offload? Like, how can I make this, like, de-stress my life enough to make space for this very big season that I'm trying to embark on? Because it is, right? And I think it takes more space for someone who lives with bipolar than someone that doesn't, because there's so many other factors to manage.
Yeah,
I mean, definitely. You know, I was pregnant a year and a half ago, and sadly my baby was diagnosed with Edwards syndrome, so I had to have a termination for medical reasons of the baby just as I got into the second trimester. And I didn't enjoy being pregnant. I found it very difficult. And I was coping, but I had to make a lot of space in my life to accommodate me being pregnant.
Yeah, I can imagine, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, so I just thought it's such a big issue, and it's such it was, you know, it's such an important issue. And also, I'm very aware that a lot of things, especially in the research world, you know, things that affect women the most tend not to be researched as much.
Yes.
And so I thought, well, you know, I'll just do my little bit, I'll get involved. And I did this PhD at King's College, and with Ian as one of my supervisors, and the amazing Professor Louise Howard, who is head of the Women's Mental Health Section, well, she was head for that, supervising me. And it was really, really illuminating, you know, because I interviewed probably about 25 women altogether, all who had bipolar, and all who about either getting pregnant or being pregnant or whatever, and how, what their experience had been. And I also interviewed a lot of psychiatrists and a few other perinatal health professionals, and it's been really useful to me, because I've had a sort of parallel, you know, work life of doing PhD, because it took me 9 years to say, because I was doing it part-time, so it's usually 4 years, so it's, you know, it takes you, and hang on, it's usually 3 years it takes people. So I was doing it in 6 years, but then I had various things that made it longer, so it did go on a bit. But it was quite handy in a way that it did go on for quite a long time, because it enabled me to do this other work in helping to set up APP and MMHA, Maternal Mental Health Alliance, both of which, you know, APP campaigns and helps women specifically who've had a postpartum psychosis. So 50% of the women who have a postpartum psychosis have bipolar.
Yeah.
And the other 50, you know, probably a third or a half of them probably also have bipolar, but it had never shown up before.
That's their first.
That's their first major trigger.
Right.
So, and so then, you know, they might go on to have non-perinatal episodes after that. But.
And the other sort of 10 to 20% then, if that isn't, if they're not living with bipolar and it's not their first episode of that then sort of springboards them into being diagnosed with bipolar, the other sort of percentage of that community, what would be the reason for them having postpartum psychosis?
Well, it's just, you know, there was 10 years ago virtually no research on it, and mainly Ian's group in Wales and wherever have done a lot of research on this now, but they still don't really know. You know, they just think it's a combination of sort of stress, you know, because sometimes women have very, very long labours and very traumatic labours, or even psychologically that they've had, you know, things happen to them in the past that affect
birth has triggered. Birth. Okay. Yeah.
And also I think people perhaps have anxiety or depression, but they don't actually have bipolar. And either of those two can also combine with it. And then if they have this big hormonal impact, because they don't know the cause, they just know that it must be a mixture of these things, because it, you know, because so many women do have a serious episode immediately after the birth, it obviously must be triggered in an almost kind of, you know, physical way.
Yeah.
So it's got to be, is that hormones have got to be implicated. Mm-hmm. It's just they don't really know how. And so for the in APP, quite a few women who are very active in it don't have bipolar, but they are, you know, I suppose they're always kind of like aware that they possibly, you know, it could rear up if something else triggered.
Yeah,
you know, they're sort of susceptible to their mind being affected by hormones and stress. Mm-hmm. And quite often, if you've had one, you know, you have a much higher risk of having another postpartum psychosis. And also at the moment I'm talking about with Bipolar UK, I'm trying to get more awareness for also those women and women with bipolar being at risk at perimenopause and menopause. because again, okay. it's a hormonal trigger.
Yes.
So we have to sort of start thinking about being prepared for that, because there's virtually no research about that.
Mm-hmm.
But so APP is a fantastic charity that really helps if, you know, people who've had a postpartum psychosis or their families or whatever, and has a really good, and we as a Bipolar UK works quite closely with APP, but obviously it's very difficult for them sometimes when they've had a PP. There's this kind of resistance to, oh, I don't have bipolar, you know, because they just want to think it was just one thing that happened. Yes. Now they're better, and that's not in my life anymore, you know.
Yeah.
Which is natural, but.
Well, I remember feeling like that when I got my diagnosis. I'll do this and I'll do that and I'll beat it, and then I'll just put that chapter behind me and I'll get on with the rest of my life. You know, it took me years to really accept that this was something that I had to live with, cohabit with, respect, and get to know. You know, that for me, it took a long time, and I was in the throes of it often, you know, so I can imagine how if it feels to you that was a one-off, how you would be very keen to just say, well, that was just one-off and I'm going to just park that and thanks. So I get that, you know, it takes time to accept that it's something that maybe you might have to live with forever. You know, that's a really hard thing to digest, isn't it, for people?
But I think it's really, it helped me, because I didn't, as I say, I didn't get involved with the charity until I was in my 40s. And so before then, I just sort of suppressed it a lot. But one thing that did help me a lot, which I think was when I was about late 20s or something anyway, my sister heard Kay Redfield Jameson on the radio. Mm-hmm. So when she just published her memoir. I'm just looking up. I've got it on my shelf here. I can't remember what it's called. What's it called? You must know.
I don't know.
Oh my God. You've got to read this book. It's the best book in the world.
Tell me.
I'll tell you.
She's gone to get her book. She's back.
There we are. Can you see that? An Unquiet Mind.
Oh.
Kay Redfield Jameson. It's the best book about bipolar you will ever, ever read.
So it's An Unquiet Mind by?
An Unquiet Mind by Kay Redfield Jameson.
Kay Redfield Jameson. I'm going to have a read of that.
And I heard her on the radio and I thought, oh my God. And then I read the book, and I have several copies of it here because I'm always giving them to people. And she's written several other books since then. And she is actually a patron of the charity. I persuaded her be a patron, but she's American.
Okay.
And the professor of psychology, and she's an amazing person. There's quite a few talks by her on YouTube and stuff. It's really worth looking
amazing
at. Yeah, because she's really great, because she, you know, she's super clever, and she was a senior psychologist, I suppose, in university. And in order to write this book, she had to stop work because, you know, in that time, whatever it was, 30 years ago, she couldn't continue because everyone was calling her mad. How can you be, you know, helping other people as a psychologist if you're mad yourself, you know? And so she had to stop because she felt she didn't want to be attacked in that way. She was attacked anyway. But so she took a huge amount of flack because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was even before social media. I mean, imagine.
Oh gosh.
And so it was really brave of her to do it. And she's continued. She's written some fantastic, she's written a very good book about suicide. She's written a really good, an amazing book about the links between creativity and bipolar,
mm-hmm.
which is fascinating. And so when I heard her, it gave me such hope, you know, to think that you can still go on being intelligent, you know. Yes. Because she took lithium, in order to try to commit suicide, she'd taken an overdose of lithium, which is a really awful way to try and to commit suicide, and she had, you know, just been pulled back from the brink. But she was obviously really, she could have been really damaged by that, because it's very toxic, and luckily she wasn't, but she she, you know, that she, the, it gave me such hope that she was still so incredibly driven to achieve and to be, to, you know, be successful, but also to help other people through what she knew and what she'd learned. And so I was so very inspired by that, and she, it really helped me a lot, because I think, like we were saying before, about, you know, feeling that your life is over, you know, I thought I was going to have a really great life and I had all sorts of things ahead of me, and now I'm a mental patient. It's that, you know, it's that kind of, you just think, oh, you just kind of, should I just give up now, kind of thing. And I think that, I think, to, you know, to hear that people, that this is not just a totally negative condition, that there are plus points about it. And when I say that, people always come back to me and say, oh, you know, I don't think there are any plus points about it, and are very sort of down on it. But, you know, they might be going through depression at that time, I don't know. But you know, I think there are plus points. I think people are quite, you know, as a personality type, we are generally very driven and very keen to, you know, to do our best at things, and that's why a lot of people with bipolar have been very successful.
And it's, we were talking sort of before we started recording, weren't we, and just saying that I've had feedback from people when they've sort of been diagnosed that yes, it can come with relief, and it can come with a feeling of, oh, how much is going to restrict my life then, and maybe I can't do all these things that I wanted to do. And and that's why I think what I said to Claire is, people like Claire is having people like you speak and share is so important, because just because we live with bipolar doesn't mean that we can't go on and do amazing things, doesn't mean that we can't do things that have impact, that are meaningful, that are purposeful, because we absolutely can. It might be a case that we need to take some time to stabilize before we can shift gears and do those things. It doesn't always mean forever, and it just means that we have to steady the ship, right, before we can plow forward again. And it's a season, we go through different seasons living with bipolar, and it's about learning the ebb and flow of that, and when you're in a good space, making the most of that and doing things that matter to you and doing things that are important, because we can still do those things. It might just look a bit different to the conventional 9 to 5, you know, but it doesn't mean they can't happen.
It's interesting though, because not only you need those sort of role models, you know, as a person with bipolar, but I mean, I think as well, it's often shocks me how many health professionals don't realize that people with bipolar are actually well most of the time and live normal lives and achieve things and everything. Because if you think, I mean, I do quite a lot of training and stuff with psychiatrists and midwives and whatnot. And I can remember being in a conference with and being in the audience for something. And I was sitting with two psychiatric nurses, and they, and I said, oh, right. I said, so, you know, I said, oh, well, you know, I have bipolar. And then they said, really? And they literally were really shocked that I was sort of there and talking to them intelligently, because they, I said, well, think about it. You are in hospital all the time. One of them had been in a, it worked in a psychiatric ward for like 10 years or something, and the other one 5 years. And they said, well, we only see people really, really ill.
Yes.
And because they get thrown out now, quite, you know, when they're still a bit ill, they never see them well. They never, and they don't, that's not their experience of, you know, they just experience, I suppose, mainly people coming in and, you know, manic.
In crisis.
Incredibly disruptive on the ward, and, you know, pain in the neck and all that kind of thing. So it's whenever I talk, because of the PhD, I've sort of presented at a lot of academic conferences. And I always start, you know, even though I'm not talking about myself, I always start with saying, I have bipolar disorder and I had a postpartum psychosis, because I feel that there's someone in the audience who's not really, you know, will think, oh gosh, you wouldn't think she had bipolar, would you? Yeah, and there's always the case. It's always the case. And so I just feel a responsibility to sort of always say that, you know, even though I get, sometimes it's, you think, well, this isn't necessarily relevant to what I'm saying, but I think it's relevant to everyone else.
It is relevant, and it's relevant in all the ways that you've said and more, because like it's not, like you say, it's not only important for those that live with bipolar, it's breaking down the stereotype view of the wider community, and that's how change happens as well, right? Yes, yeah. There's this really important part that you and I are both really passionate about, which is making sure that people in the bipolar community don't feel alone and they're advocated for and they're taken seriously. And outside of our bubble, our bipolar bubble, you know, the rest of the world, you know, this is debunking those myths, you know, and showing the all faces of people, the community that live with bipolar. And it's so diverse and so personal to each person as well. So you are working on the Bipolar Commission.
Yes.
So I would love you to tell us a bit about that and what's been going on and kind of where you're at.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Bipolar Commission was set up last year to try and sort of really shine a light on where we are with bipolar, and so that we can gather sort of evidence from people and then perhaps sort of highlight what services are like at the moment and where they could improve, which, you know, I think we all know they definitely could improve. Mm-hmm. Simon Kitchen, the CEO, is a moving light in it, and I'm the co-chair as a service user with Professor Guy Goodwin of Oxford, who's a sort of real bipolar expert, mm-hmm. and friend of the charity, and a lot of obviously people in the office and everything, but we've got a whole lot of commissioners who live with bipolar, who are, you know, have got involved and are help giving us evidence, and we've also been interviewing a lot of researchers in the area and clinicians as well, you know, different psychologists and GPs and people, and how they, just how things actually work in practice now.
Mm-hmm.
Because we haven't ever had a bipolar commission, though there was one on schizophrenia about 10 or 12 years ago. And it's important to shed a light on it, I think, because certainly the evidence that we've had so far from a lot of experts is that, you know, bipolar is very poorly served,
mm-hmm.
you know, both in research terms and, more importantly, I suppose, in service terms, because mm-hmm. it's quite often just sort of lumped in with psychosis, you know, which is mm-hmm. mainly the focus is on schizophrenia. And so all the sort of very different life cycle kind of thing, the, like, you know, how it affects your lifestyle over many years is not really accommodated for at all in services. You know, it's just only if you're in a crisis do you get any help.
Yes.
And then you just ignored.
Yes, that's definitely what happened to me when I was poorly. I got assessed for depression and anxiety and then put on a 6-month waiting list to see someone that was more informed, that could explore other diagnoses, by which point, you know, actively suicidal, actively trying to take my own life, putting other people's lives in danger as well as my own. You know, it really does get to a point where it really could be life or death for me and others around me because of my unwellness. Because, you know, you're not given, well, back then 10 years ago, wasn't given a basic assessment for bipolar, which could have fast-tracked me to help. You know, if I'd have been given a depression, anxiety and a bipolar kind of tick box thing, I would have shown up as highly probable having bipolar and needs to be further assessed. But instead I'm just marked down as depressed and anxious and stuck on a waiting list for 6 months. Yeah, meanwhile, life is not safe.
No, exactly. And I think it's so short-sighted. I know it happens all the time in services, but, you know, it's always just a sticking plaster. And when you've got it is applied, as opposed to trying to prevent something terrible happening.
Yeah.
And, or, you know, or even prevent you having a mild episode, which might lose your job or something, you know, or whatever.
I lost my business and everything when I was probably 10 years ago. Yeah.
Gosh, yeah. And I just think it's so crazy. I mean, I particularly, from my experience with the Maternal Mental Health Alliance, because we did a lot of campaigning at Westminster and everything to try and get better services for women with severe mental illness, particularly. And now we've moved on to sort of more all women in maternity services. But it started out with those of us who are, you know, at the sort of severe end, very worried about women who were not able to go to mother and baby units, you know, and because there were 45% of the country, that was the coverage. Mm-hmm. So, and that was for England. I mean, it was even worse. I mean, Northern Ireland still haven't got a mother and baby unit. And so if you haven't got those services and those illnesses not being recognised, you know, so obviously coming from APP and Bipolar UK, we were aware of, you know, several deaths because of that, because we committed suicide. And so we were able to, you know, argue very strongly, this cannot go on. And I feel that we can learn a lot in our Bipolar Commission from the experience of Maternal Mental Health Alliance, because Dr. Alan Gregoire, who is sort of moving force in the MMHA, you know, he showed that if you just put a small amount of money in to raise the services to an acceptable level, you would save, you know, like 10 times as much, because we had an economic report commissioned which showed that, you know, if your mother was depressed or your mother was ill postnatally, you were much more likely to be depressed yourself when you were older, or as a child, you're much more likely to not do as well at school. You're much more likely to have, you know, contact with the criminal justice system. All these things which, you know, in economic analysis, they can put a price to.
Mm-hmm.
And also the price of women themselves being, you know, out of the workforce and everything else, and how much it costs the NHS if they're ill for a long time. And all of that was sort of added up, and it showed that you could save this.
Yeah,
you could, you know, just by this small amount of investment, you could save this
astronomical amounts of money.
So to have that economic argument alongside the very powerful argument of, he was a perinatal psychiatrist, and we would always at presentations have him talking with a woman with lived experience of, you know, having made a suicide attempt or whatever because of not getting any help when she had her baby and she was very ill. And the combination of having those two things was phenomenal, you know, and made a real impact. And now, you know, we've had this fantastic investment into perinatal services to make that 45% 100% across the country.
Yes.
And perinatal teams all over the country. You know, we're still, as an alliance, we're still continuing to campaign to improve things in Wales and Scotland and particularly Northern Ireland, but also to sort of improve things further down the line, you know, for women who have who are not going to go to a mother and baby unit, mm-hmm. but they still need help. They still need postnatal, you know, groups, support groups, yeah. and like that, and yeah. that kind of investment.
Well, that lower level support, like support groups, can be the thing that would prevent someone needing to go into a unit,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Because but if I that mean, person gets that support, then they don't, it may not escalate as far, you know? These things are really, this support's so crucial for women.
But also, you know, from a bipolar point of view, if you have just a little bit of input in terms of checking in with an actual psychiatrist every year or something,
yes.
just you could on Zoom or something, you know, just briefly, if you just checked in with somebody and you're allowed to have, you know, regular medication reviews and, you know, lifestyle reviews, and encouraged to join support groups and things like that, none of which really happens because you're more or less chucked out of hospital and the GPs don't really want to know, do they? And if you're well on your medication, then there's no sort of preventative work.
No, it's just crisis management, really. And it's like, yeah. Well, that's that person quiet for a bit longer. Where's the next crisis? It's like firefighting, right?
Yeah, it is. And I feel for them because, you know, it must be really awful. I mean, I think that they've made the psychiatrist job so much worse, and they've made the chance of recruiting enough psychiatrists, you know, because there is a shortage, but they've made that much worse by adopting this system of these crisis management teams instead of in the old days, you know. But Guy Goodwin says this a lot, but you know, you used to have much more continuity of care because you would actually see the same psychiatrist, and so not only for the patient was that a million times better, but it was so much better for the psychiatrist.
It must be.
Develop a relationship with that person.
As a professional, it must be easier.
Yeah, exactly. And they can feel that they are actually helping somebody rather than just seeing someone, oh, I've never seen you before, see someone else and I've seen you before, you know, like that.
But not only that, just from both sides, if you only see someone once, you don't have that history to know, oh, they're much different than they were last time, or, you know.
Exactly.
So from a treating point of view of being able to give the right clinical guidance and medical guidance, it's got to be easier for them to have continuity of care also, because they're getting the full picture, not just this little snapshot, and then chuck something at that snapshot, move on, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, so the Bipolar Commission is in progress.
It's in progress. I'm hoping we've had some preliminary preliminary report about it that we launched in Westminster before Christmas. But we are hoping to do some more surveys and things. So, I mean, anybody who watches this, please look out for them from Bipolar UK and
take part in the surveys.
Yeah, I mean, at my little bit of it in particular, I'm focusing on women in bipolar. And at the moment, I'm doing a series of webinars for Bipolar UK about issues that affect women. So I've done one about hormones in relation to sort of contraception and periods and that kind of stuff. And then just before Christmas, I did one about pregnancy and childbirth with Professor Ian Jones. And that's on the website and on the YouTube thing, I think.
I was going to ask, where can people find them? So on the Bipolar website.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's on the website, and it's also, well, I think it's on the YouTube channel as well.
Okay.
And so that hopefully is quite helpful. And I put a lot of info in that and a lot of signposting to other things that are quite helpful. So there are quite a few things now related to what you need to do if you're thinking about having a child on the website. If you go on and you just put pregnancy into the search, you get most of them up. I mean, not in any order, but you know, you get a lot of them up there. And there's a few interviews and podcasts and whatnot. So in the webinar series, which there's four of them, those two I've done. So the next one will be about perimenopause and menopause. And how that affects bipolar, and that will be, and I'm hoping to have a GP who is a specialist in menopause join me to answer questions and things. So we haven't planned when that is yet, but it'll probably be in the next couple of months. And then the fourth one of the series in the summer will be, I think, about parenting bipolar.
Do you know what I've had a request for, and I don't know if this is something that you know someone that could give the best advice on. I've been going through IVF, so I've just done my eighth round of fertility treatment, and I'm connected with quite a lot of women that are needing to have fertility treatment, right? Just because they live with bipolar doesn't suddenly mean they're immune from infertility. There's a lot of concern about how they will manage being injected with all of these hormones whilst living with bipolar, and I know firsthand it's tough. It's really tough to juggle both. And I've had a lot of people come and ask me, you know, who could we get advice from on how to navigate IVF whilst living with bipolar on a professional level? So I don't know if you know anyone, but
that's interesting. Yeah,
it's something that you know, I think really does get massively overlooked in the bipolar community, because just, you know, you're not, nobody's immune from fertility struggles.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. And then of course you go through something like IVF where you're injecting yourself, you know, with mad levels of hormones whilst trying to stay well. Bearing in mind, to do IVF, most people have reduced a lot of their medications, so you're already working really hard to stay well, and then you're injecting yourself. You know, I've just done 53 days worth of injections.
Gosh.
It's a lot. And obviously I share my experience on my page and that helps, but I'm not a professional, I'm just me living my life going through it. So I've had a lot of people who would love to hear a professional voice on this. I don't know how that even happens. And
yeah, well, I mean, I'll certainly ask a few people, you know, who work in this area and see, and then perhaps they could be best if you interviewed them or something. That would be the best thing, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'd love to do that, because, I mean, obviously this is your area of sort of expertise as well. And it, I think it would be, I would love to have that conversation with you and somebody else who can bring element to it, because I know that it's enough. I've had a few people say that they are, you know, they come and say they're worried about having children, but then also on top of that, if they're struggling with fertility struggles, they're saying, I don't even know if it's worth the risk of having fertility treatment because of everything that I have to do to prepare myself to have it. And then I'm going to be injecting all these hormones. I'm not even dealing with just normal pregnancy hormones. I'm dealing with, like, you know, these crazy hormones. It's just off the charts, you know. So there's a lot of fear around it, which I completely understand, and you know, I share my own crackers little journey as I go, but that's just me, just one person, one experience. It's not a big enough voice to help lots of people, you know. So I'd love to explore
you're
that
absolutely
bit more.
Right, yeah, and that is something that I should have included probably. Yeah, so definitely I'll look into that and see who would be the best person to talk about it, because as far as I mean I've spoken to a couple of women who said they were, you know, the problems they had with IVF. I just remember one, but she actually had trouble with her GP or her psychiatrist recommending her for IVF.
Yes,
wouldn't recommend her, and she she took them to court and won.
I mean, it does sort of lead to quite discriminating decisions being made on your family planning. I mean, it does. Yeah,
absolutely. And a lot of that is from ignorance and
lack of information.
Yeah. And also, you know, if they don't have much knowledge of, like, your GP or whatever, if they're not very knowledgeable about bipolar, then maybe they
are fearful.
They don't know how well you're going to be, how you're going to cope, all those kind of things.
Yeah.
I mean, I think certainly, you know, you have to be responsible, and you have to think, if you were someone who was in hospital 3 or 4 times a year, then, you know, when you didn't have a partner there or something, then obviously you think, well, how realistic is it? You know, how good is this going to be for a child? But if you're someone who is generally, you know, does everything right and keeps yourself well and, you know, manages your lifestyle and everything else, plus has other support, because I think that's a really big thing when you're taking on something like this that is a bit of an unknown quantity. You need to know that you have people around you, or, you know, accessible in some way to support you.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I wouldn't have got through the last 2 and a bit years without support around me, and lots of it, and baby loss. You know, it's just, there's just no way I would still be standing.
Because
it's just too much. And so many sort of changes in life have had to happen to accommodate it all, you know. Life looks very, very different to how it did 3 years ago, because I've had to make so much space, because I knew that I would need that much wiggle room, that much grace, because I know that it was going to just push me to my coping limit, you know. So if I don't offload,
yes,
then you break, right? You've got this, you can only take so much load, right? And if the load's too great, then something's got to go. And after 10 years ago having that breakdown, I just knew I wasn't prepared for that something to go to be me. So I'm like, right, you know, work's got to change, that's got to change, this has got to change, social life's got to change to make space for this, you know, this cracker's little journey that I'm on. Claire, it has been lovely talking to you today, and thank you for that book recommendation. I'm going to go away and read it. And I hope that we get to connect again soon as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I'll do my best to find out about some info on IVF and bipolar, and I shall get back to you.
Oh, please do. Yeah, I know a couple of maybe 3 or 4 women with bipolar who are also kind of in this sort of IVF space. So if you needed a few voices or few people to ask questions to or whatever, then I could probably find them.
Yeah. That would be good, wouldn't it?
Okay. Thank you so much, Claire, for today. Yeah. And I know that I've had a lot of questions come into the podcast about resources for pregnancy, hormones, all of that. So I am really pleased to hear that there's these webinars available on the Bipolar UK website and on the YouTube channel. So you can go and check them out on there, because I know that people are really, really wanting these resources. So thank you so much for providing them.
Okay, fantastic. All right. Cheerio then.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, the podcast brought to you by Bipolar UK. Please go to our website, www.bipolaruk.org, for all of our resources and all of the support that we can offer you.